I want to welcome everyone to the final installments of our series, The History of Israel. This is part 13A, the 2000s, now and beyond. And as always, I want to thank Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring this series, L'ilui Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and thank everyone for participating all these many months as we began with the history of the modern Zionist movement, or better said, the modern return to Israel. And we'll look at the last few years, and if we can, try to project as best as human beings can sometime into the future. As the year 2000 unfolded, the consequences of the Oslo process were apparent in a very deadly and dramatic way on Israeli society. It's very difficult to speak about the last 15 years, certainly not the last 6 or 7 years, without sounding like the Meraglim and only focusing on terrible trends and misdeeds and miscalculations and poor leadership in Israeli society. But we'll do our best not to sound like the Meraglim. One of the consequences of Oslo was the mainstreaming of post-Zionism, sort of related to what's called now in Israel the New Historians. The post-Zionists began as a fringe, extreme movement in the 1980s. They're academics who adopted a revisionist view of Israeli history, Jewish academics. They maintained and they sought the documentary proof. Sometimes if it didn't exist, they fabricated it or they interpreted vague documents in line with their thinking. But they essentially posited that, for example, the Arabs were actually expelled in 1948 by the Israelis. That, in fact, Britain had tried to thwart the creation of a Palestinian state while at the same time trying to facilitate the creation of a Jewish state, the State of Israel. They maintained, the post-Zionists did, that the wars in 1948, the War of Independence, and the Six-Day War of 1967 were always going to be obvious Israeli victories. Israel were never the underdogs, but in fact they were the colonial clients of powerful empires. That all the tragedies and all the troubles of the last 60 years were Israel's fault. That Israel had always rejected Arab peace overtures, that in fact the Arabs had never wanted to destroy Israel, and Israel had always favored and propagated the bellicose policies against the Arabs. Add to that the mantras that they adopted, that the occupation is evil, the occupation corrupts society, the occupation tarnishes the soul, and the effect on society was devastating and began already in the 90s, but certainly in the 2000s, to weaken the people's will and resolve and make them think that indeed the occupation was evil. In fact, it was Oslo that was evil, and Oslo that corrupted society, and Oslo that tarnished the soul of Israel, and Oslo devastated Israeli society in a way which they have not yet recovered from. Now, the end result of the New Historians, who still exist, was that the Israelis began to doubt their historical narrative. They began to question the justice of their cause. And this engendered guilt in the leftist elite, who in fact without Torah could never explain why indeed they were in the land of Israel, why they belonged there. And of course, this guilt affected politicians and their policies, certainly the media, and eventually the public as well. And the attitude became, well, we threw the Arabs out in 1948. The world felt guilty over the Holocaust, but what we did was wrong and immoral and, in fact, un-Jewish. So we must rectify it in any way, at any price, and any casualties we suffer are just penance. Now, of course, it was never said in that clear way, although it was not far from that, but nonetheless, this was the dominant attitude of the intellectual elite in the 90s. Now, even though the security equation improved in the early 1990s, the so-called Intifada, the civil war, the civil rebellion was petering out, the political goal was not security. The political goal was, so to speak, ending the occupation, and even though security deteriorated after Oslo, the goal was, so to speak, accomplished. The occupation was ended. Yitzhak Rabin had said to the Arabs, or this in public, "We do not desire to rule your lives." Of course, Oslo proved, and events today again confirm, that occupation, that is to say, a physical presence in the land of Israel, and security are both intertwined and inseparable. So whereas in the 1970s and 80s, support for PLO state was the defining characteristic of being anti-Israel, now support for a PLO state became mainstream, and opposition to a Palestinian state was a sign of a flawed mind and perhaps also an immoral and corrupted soul. And as that didn't work, a new mantra of the elites began in the 2000s. Is a Jewish state even feasible? Was Israel a mistake? And so even today there is a increasing drumbeat that the only solution to the Middle East problem would be a binational state, not even separate states of Arabs and Jews, because the Arabs will never accept that, but rather a binational state in which the Arabs would have the upper hand. And of course the question then becomes, the very powerful question that they ask, is having our own flag, is having a Jewish state, is having an anthem really worth any Jewish life? What's the difference what the flag of the state looks like? Now, aside from the fact that that would represent the death knell for the state of Israel and a Jewish state, it's important to note that the new historians, the post-Zionists, were all Israelis and all Jewish. There was no corresponding reassessment in the Arab world. There's never been a movement in the Arab world of permanent tolerance for a Jewish state, nor has there ever been a movement, a sustained movement in the Arab world, which questioned the moves of Arab leaders or pointed out mistakes of Arab leaders. So a person who points out the mistake of one of the Arab dictators, usually that's the last mistake he makes in his own life. So therefore, the end result was that the Arabs were emboldened by this Israeli weakness, and they recognized that a loss of will is a sure sign of a nation in decline. Now what happened in the 90s also is that Israel unilaterally changed the definition of the struggle from existential to territorial. That is to say, they maintained, in defiance of the reality, but nonetheless, they maintained that the Arabs do not want to destroy Israel, again, absorbing the post-Zionist doctrine. The Arabs never wanted to destroy Israel or negate its existence. It's rather just a question of territory. So we'll give a little, we'll lose a little, we'll maintain a little, and then we'll have peace. And of course the Arabs willfully played along with this, some echoing the same line, as in the Fatah, or certain elements in Fatah, and others pledging eternal jihad, which today is Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, and others. And of course Arafat himself played both sides of the fence, telling the West and the Israelis that the dispute is only territorial, and of course telling the Arabs and the Arab world that the dispute was existential. Something else happened in the 90s, and especially towards the late 90s, that affected Israeli society in the 2000s, and that is, again, sad to say, corruption became the norm of Israeli life, and it was worse than the protectia that always existed, but was certainly dominant in the early years of the state. The fact is the occupation did not corrupt. It was Oslo that corrupted. The first consequence is that Jewish life was no longer sacrosanct in the land of Israel. Jews became pawns to the peace process. In Paris's phrase, sacrifices for peace. In the arguments of the left, well, more people are lost in traffic accidents than to terror. Votes were openly bought and sold in the Knesset to have agreements passed. Oslo too passed because, as the saying went, two Mitsubishis, two members of the right-wing party Tzomet, were bribed to become deputy ministers, given Mitsubishis, and in fact they abandoned a party that was against the peace process simply to make money. One of them now sits in prison, having left politics and entered the business of selling ecstasy, and he was caught. It was one of the people on whom Oslo II passed. It passed by two votes, one of them his. The European Union and others intervened in elections. We discussed last time the entire Carter campaign team came to Israel in 1999 in order to see to it that Ehud Barak was elected. Israeli politicians and elites went into business with Arafat, including the casino in Yericho, which made millions from the open border while terrorists slipped through. Sad to say, the primary customers of the casino in Yericho were Israelis. And they were paying, they were gambling, and the money was going to support terror, which was killing them. Nonetheless, it was very difficult to close until the war in 2002 mandated that it be closed. The intelligence services targeted Jews, continuing a pattern from the 1980s, making sure that the settler movement and other right-wing Jews were kept under wraps. They were infiltrated by government agents. At times, as we discussed last time, those government agents fomented anti-government or confrontational tactics in a way which blackened the reputation of the right-wing movement amongst the Israeli population. The judicial system, truth be told, became corrupted as well. In 1995, Aharon Barak became the Chief Justice, and he revolutionized judicial power in Israel. Israel's Supreme Court became what was described as the most powerful Supreme Court in the world. Since it had no political overview or accountability, Barak simply usurped the power of the legislative branch. There is no effective executive branch in Israel. And he began on his own, passing and annulling legislation, declaring Knesset laws unconstitutional. A neat trick, because Israel has no constitution. But nonetheless, he would declare those laws unconstitutional. He would make non-legal issues justiciable. Elections, expulsion of terrorists, demolition of terrorist homes, Shabbos traffic, all of which are either government issues or foreign policy issues, or in fact local, domestic, municipal issues. But he made the court in such a way that everything and everyone came to the high court. Israel has a very open standing doctrine. Anyone can bring any motion or application before the High Court of Justice to challenge something in the government. By contrast, in America, one needs standing. One needs to be personally harmed by a particular government action in order to sue for it. Not so in Israel. Anybody could sue, and they gave him the right, once a person was brought forward to sue the government, to essentially make government policy on every area he so chose. He insinuated the court into military matters. And of course, he decided cases not based on law, such as it exists in Israel, or of course Torah, but the views of what he said were the enlightened members of society, which meant Barak and his hand-picked fellow justices. One of the problems we'll discuss in a few moments. So naturally, the court had a pronounced anti-religious, anti-national bias. So for example, in the early 2000s, the High Court of Justice of Israel, the Supreme Court, entertained a motion to ban Mila as barbaric. Imagine that. Just let that sink in for a moment. The highest Jewish court in the Jewish state of Israel heard an application and held a hearing to decide whether bris milah, circumcision, is barbaric or not. Or the court intervened to prevent numerous demolitions of terrorist homes or the expulsion of terrorists, of Arab terrorists. But of course they refused to intervene in the expulsion of Jews and the demolition of their homes in Gush Katif. As bad as that is, something is even worse. The court is a self-perpetuating oligarchy. 95% of the justices are secular, leftist, Ashkenaz Tel Avivians, and they allow one religious seat, who's usually a liberal religious Jew in any event, and they control the appointments. The commission includes three justices, the attorney general, the minister of justice, and even the minister of justice and the attorney general need the informal approval of the Chief Justice. So therefore, you'll never have a situation where there's an attorney general or a minister of justice who won't, so to speak, play ball with the High Court. and anyone who's perceived as an outsider, Roni Bar-On, for example, whose appointment as Attorney General was challenged and he was not allowed to be appointed, Yaakov Neman, who was indicted for absolutely nothing in order to prevent him from being appointed Minister of Justice, Tzachi Hanegbi, who has an indictment hanging over his head now for 10 years, all of them were kept in line, so there cannot be any independent Attorney General or Justice Minister. As it is, today's Minister of Justice, Daniel Friedman, is independent. Barak has already left the court, and he has clashed with the court, held, in fact, criticized publicly by voices emanating from the court as being anti-democratic, because he's trying to restrain some of the excesses of the court, especially in their power to appoint themselves. That parsha still has not yet been fully resolved. But the way the court operated, certainly under Barak, the media and the liberal elites controlled the justices. The justices controlled the social, legal, and political agenda. And of course, democracy suffers because the votes don't matter at all. Anyone who wants to change the system to conform to a more American style is branded as dangerous. And if you are too outspoken, you can be indicted for the crime of insulting a public official, which, bear in mind, is a crime that is prosecuted in Israel, but it's prosecuted very selectively. There is no so-called right-wing justice on the High Court. Just a few years ago, in the early 2000s, a professor at Hebrew University, and Ruth Gavison, was nixed by Barak because she had been a critic of the court. She has more right-wing views. She's the one who made the statement that Israel's Supreme Court is the most powerful in the world, and she said the court is answerable only to itself, and Barak was able successfully to prevent her appointment as a minister, as a Supreme Court justice. It's impossible to change, and so people lost faith in the court. Especially religious and right-wing Jews have lost faith in the court. Not only that, the litany of Israeli politicians in the last 10, 15 years who have been either investigated or indicted include almost everyone. Aryeh Deri, Tzachi Hanegbi, Yitzhak Mordechai, Avigdor Kalani, Chaim Ramon, Omri Sharon, Ariel Sharon, Binyamin Netanyahu, Ehud Olmert, Moshe Katzav, Ezer Weitzman, Roni Bar-On, Ehud Barak, etc. It's a long list. It includes everyone, or almost everyone, who has achieved any high position in Israel. And of course, to be indicted does not necessarily mean you'll be prosecuted. To be prosecuted and convicted does not necessarily mean the sentence will be carried out. Doesn't even mean you have to leave government office. Chaim Ramon was convicted. He served a sentence, and today he's the deputy prime minister. Omri Sharon was convicted, and now he's waiting for his sentence. He's supposed to go to jail for 9 months, already now for over 2 years. He has just been able to stay out because of his father's illness. So justice, unfortunately, in Israel is very selectively applied, and it serves a higher end. That higher end, of course, is not Torah or anything noble. That higher end are the self-serving interests of the political elites. So the other consequence of Oslo, and that is what people began to perceive as the so-called necessity of peace. Since they can't live without it, they can't live without peace, people were told, they elected leaders who would promise peace. Despite all the odds and despite all the illusions, all a leader had to do was promise that he would bring peace in some way, and he would successfully win elections, especially since his predecessor had usually failed abjectly. The public, the Israeli public, apparently is neither that inquisitive nor that discerning in their choice of leaders. So in the 90s and the 2000s, they bounced from leader to leader, from promise to promise, from right to left, and then to back again. Thus, they went from the right-wing Shamir to the left-wing Rabin, and Paris took over for Rabin, the right-wing Netanyahu, the left-wing Barak, the right-wing Sharon, and then the left-wing Sharon, Sharon and Olmert. And the bounce is always from security to peace. Shamir promises security, Rabin promises peace. Netanyahu security, Barak peace. Sharon Security, and then Sharon, second Sharon Olmert for peace. So society is inherently unstable. The political climate is inherently unstable, and many people still functioning intellectually bemoan the schizophrenia in Israeli society, how the public is so easily manipulated. Another consequence, wealth. Israeli society for the first time had an influx of tremendous wealth, inordinate wealth. Oslo made Israel the temporary darlings of the international community. And our office was open in Qatar, an Arab country, the diplomatic relations of several Arab countries as well. That and the technological boom of the 1990s, in which Israel was a world leader in high tech. Many things that we benefit from, the voice of the internet, video of the internet, EasyPass for that matter, were all products of Israeli companies by Israelis who had been trained in the army. This brought unprecedented wealth into Israeli society, and the standard of living exceeded that of much of Europe, and then an attitude seeped into the body politic, I can live the good life, why fight for anything? So just give back. If this is what they want for peace, give back. And if they want more, give that back too. It also created two societies, a modern wealthy society on the one hand and a Middle Eastern poor society on the other hand. As in any society, the educated classes earn more, and this led to a greater divide in society. Sfardim, Haredim, Arabs earn substantially less, and therefore this created even more tensions in society. As the economy became more privatized in the late 90s and early 2000s, subsidies and welfare were cut. Netanyahu himself, when he was the finance minister in Sharon's first term, he instituted a number of economic reforms that rewarded work and penalized those who did not want to work. So this also exacerbated tensions between the haves and the have-nots. Nonetheless, by the late 1990s, new educational opportunities for Haredim began in the technological areas, but even those were slow to win rabbinic approval in those more insulated communities, as the primacy of Torah study and a fear of what would happen if Haredim entered the general workplace was more pervasive. One other consequence of Oslo that Israel lives with until today, although it changed somewhat in the 2000s for a time, their security and defense doctrines changed. The IDF became very reactive in the 90s, and people became very defensive. Rather than deal with the problems, the sources of terror, they dealt with band-aids, built bypass roads, or fences, or bulletproof windows on vehicles, cars, or buses, or simply, don't go there. Now that, of course, generated tremendous unease in society. It brought temporary relief, but of course there are no permanent solutions. People can tunnel under fences. Terrorists can shoot rockets over walls. So those were not solutions, those were band-aids. Nonetheless, those are the band-aids that were chosen, which led in the late 90s and the early 2000s to substantial deaths of Jews. And the IDF became more political as well, to maintain the illusion that that the peace was coming and that Arafat was a partner for peace. So Israel bought Arafat's denunciations of terror, which took place regularly, usually after every incident of terror, and they provided him with weapons and training and money, a lot of money. Arafat maintained an account in a Tel Aviv bank, in which the Palestine Authority gasoline tax money was sent directly, not to mention the Swiss bank accounts that Arafat maintained, so much so that British intelligence estimated that Arafat personally was worth over $7 billion, that $7 billion at his death. People who wonder why the billions that were poured into the Judeo-Samarian Gaza to help the Arabs in the 90s, help rebuild their infrastructure, provide them, why nothing has been changed and no refugee camps were ever liquidated and new housing and jobs provided for them. Well, just check Arafat's bank statements and those of his cronies and you'll know where the money went. The problem, of course, was that Israel was fully complicit in Arafat absconding with American or European Union money and using it to fund terror, to buy arms, to pay his soldiers, pay his officers, pay terrorists, and pay the families of suicide bombers. New Prime Minister took over shortly before the new century began, Ehud Barak. Ehud Barak changed his name from Brog when he entered the army in 1959, one of the most decorated veterans of the IDF, the head of the Sayeret Matkal. He led many famous missions. One, he dressed as a woman in a raid on the PLO in Beirut in the early 70s, we discussed. He was the one of the heads of the mission to Entebbe in 1976. They're very bright, has a master's in engineering from Stanford, but also very arrogant, very secretive, and that would define his tenure and his downfall. He beat Netanyahu in 1999 in a landslide, 56-44%, direct election for prime minister, but the Knesset was very fragmented. The One Israel Party, Barak's party, had 26 mandates, Likud 19 seats, Shas 17, Shas grew exponentially, Meretz 10, so Barak cobbled the coalition together with Shas and Meretz and small parties. His immediate effort, as soon as he took office in July 1999, was to engage in diplomacy and once again solve the problems of the Middle East. Barak took over 8 months after the Y Accords were signed. At Y, Israel committed to freeing Palestinian prisoners and to giving over sovereignty of Hebron to the Arabs, to building a port in Gaza, to safe passage between Gaza and Judea, all of which, of course, had been promised before. And again, all that was asked from the Arabs was that they refrain from terror, more or less. But Arafat interpreted Y as requiring a full withdrawal from Yasha and Yerushalayim before final status talks began. He may have been misled in this by Clinton, who led him to believe he would get more at Y than in fact was in the final document. Within 2 weeks after taking office, Barak was already in Washington, D.C. and essentially offering the store. Clinton, who never got along with Netanyahu, said before Barak's arrival that, I quote, "I feel like a young kid with a new toy," meaning Barak will be his new toy. Bibi was the toy that he could not control, more or less. So Clinton immediately asked Barak for a goodwill gesture. It's also a staple of this process that only the Israelis need make goodwill gestures, never Arabs. And of course Barak agreed, and he agreed to permanently free settlements through final status talks. Now, a crucial issue centered on the contiguity of a Palestinian state. It should not be disconnected areas under the maps that were drawn up to allow the continued existence, at least at the time it was contemplated, of the Jewish settlements. Various blocks were carved out of Judea-Samaria, and they would be given to the Arabs, but of course those blocks were disconnected. Arafat asked that they be connected, and those were the talks on contiguity. Barak himself had a new conceptual scheme. He would halt all interim talks, and he'd proceed to final status talks, that is to say, resolve everything once and for all. This grandiose gesture suited Clinton, who was nearing the end of his term. His term had been disgraced with the Lewinsky issues and the impeachment and the trial. So Clinton yearned for a legacy. That led Barak to become Clinton's poodle, essentially acquiescing to every American proposal and ultimately to the Camp David fiasco in the summer of 2000. Now, Barak would serve as prime minister for 18 months, and his populist policies have turned out to be grave strategic blunders. Of course, he says that he's learned from his mistakes, now ready to try again, and so therefore he's, strange it sounds, Israel's defense minister again. Meanwhile, Arafat issued a new demand for implementation of the right of return of all Arab refugees even before final status talks. Of course, that idea and the very term right of return was swiped from the Jewish experience as PLO propaganda had long claimed the status of victims just like the Jews. At the same time that Barak is in Washington, Arafat is making these demands, a new wave of Hamas terrorists are being trained right outside Tehran. In October 1999, Hillary Clinton visits Israel, visits Ramallah, hugs Suha Arafat, right, Arafat's wife, right after Suha Arafat makes a speech in which she accuses Israel of using poison gas to kill Palestinian children. She says that she was not aware of what was being said. Of course, why then would she give her Yashakayach afterwards? But nonetheless, that hug has served to haunt her in certain circles, but many Jews overlook that and prefer to focus on other aspects of her personality. Also, in late 1999, to mollify the religious, the Tal law was passed, a commission trying to determine what would be with the exemptions that Haredim were given from service in Sahal. The Tal law, in fact, enshrined the Haredi exemption, which angered both the left and angered the Mafdalniks, the religious right-wingers who, by and large, serve in the army. At the same time, in late 1999, there was an agreement that was made as a result of negotiations that took place in Sharm el-Sheikh, called the Sharm Agreement, to actually implement the Y Agreement. Israel agreed to free prisoners who had, quote, only, unquote, killed Arabs and wounded Jews. If you had killed Jews, you weren't subject to release, but if you killed Arabs, then Barak said that he would release them. The very next day, to celebrate the agreement, car bombs in both Haifa and Tveria killed the terrorists and killed Israeli Arabs as well. This proved that the more concessions were made, the more the appetite for more concessions, but no one in government wanted to learn that lesson. The main deal at Sharm el-Sheikh was to complete the final status talks within 1 year, which was quite ambitious. Bizarrely, it freed the PA from fulfilling any of its prior obligations, including limits on weapons or troop levels or incitements. This is a Clinton specialty. Clinton was happy as long as agreements were signed in public with fanfare and terror was denounced verbally, even if terror was not ended. So to have an agreement that freed one side from fulfilling its prior agreements, well, that is one of the unique aspects of the Oslo process. The two memorable events in the Barak term as Prime Minister. One was the withdrawal of all Israeli forces from Lebanon. Barak ran on a platform of ending Israel's presence in Lebanon, which had provoked constant protests, including the Four Mothers movement, worn down by guerrilla war with Hezbollah that was orchestrated by Syria. Barak's scheme was to put Syria to the test, offer wide-ranging concessions on the Golan, and end any pretext for hostility. So at Shepherdstown, Maryland, in January 2000, right before the beginning of Clinton's final year in office, Clinton presided over a summit, including Barak and Syria's Foreign Minister al-Sharaa, who refused even to shake Barak's hand, who in fact refused to agree to anything. Now, Clinton had privately assured Hafez al-Assad that Rabin's offer of 1995 was still in effect, even though it was revoked by Netanyahu. In this, Clinton was a little disingenuous, perhaps a lot disingenuous, but nonetheless, he was lying to both sides in order to get some agreement. Then he revealed Israel's red lines to Assad, who then construed them as Israel's opening bid. As Assad was dying, he demanded full withdrawal from the Golan as a precondition to any peace agreement. That is to say, Israel would have to withdraw first from the Golan, and then they would start talking about there being peace. The full withdrawal included control over Israel's water rights to the tributaries to the Jordan River. Barak agreed to full withdrawal. He balked at control of the tributaries, and they couldn't agree on where the June 4th, 1967 border was. Clinton offered American troops, and he offered early warning stations the stations would not be ready even for 5 years, but the withdrawal would take place earlier than that. Of course, this sparked in America a no U.S. troops on the Golan movement to try to pressure Congress, and in fact it was more or less successful, although since Syria refused full peace, under the thinking that why reward Israeli aggression of 1967 with normalization, they consider peace even a reward, so the talks died a natural death. Assad then, in early 2000, heated up Lebanon with new attacks on Israeli soldiers there. Barak decided to force his hand, Assad's hand, by retreating from Lebanon, which he accomplished in the dead of night. Now, already in March, Barak engaged in secret talks with Hezbollah and Iran in Berlin, and Barak there, through his intermediaries, without consulting the IDF, committed to a full withdrawal with protection for the South Lebanese army, who would remain as a buffer in the south, the SLA being Israel's longtime Christian allies in the south. But by May, Barak had abandoned completely Israel's Christian allies. He left Lebanon on the night of May 23rd, 24th. The chief of staff, Shaul Mofaz, the IDF, were livid. They were told even days earlier that a pullout would not take place for weeks. An order came in to leave immediately. The IDF left behind ammunition, communications equipment, clothing. In some cases, they left even food on the table. They ran back to the border. Next day, more than 6,600 Lebanese lined up at the Israeli border to enter. Barak trumpeted his achievement, compliance with UN Security Council Resolution 425. Within weeks, though, Hezbollah had moved to the border, began harassing the IDF. Within months, they had scattered 10,000 rockets around South Lebanon, which would later pulverize the north of Israel. In Gaza, Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon led to rallies and chants, Lebanon today, Palestine tomorrow. Meanwhile, a few weeks later, on June 10th, Hafez al-Assad died, succeeded by his son Bashar al-Assad, and Hardov, known to the world as Sheba Farms, was claimed by Lebanon. That became a pretext for both Hezbollah and Lebanon and Syria for claiming that Israel had not fully withdrawn from the Golan. The problem, of course, was that Hardov was captured from Syria in 1967, not from Lebanon. Syria had previously taken it from Lebanon. Lebanon wants it back. Syria wanted it back. Israel, even if wanted to give it back, would not know who to give it to. But that remains until today a pretext for hostilities in the north. The second major initiative of Barak while he was in power was the Camp David negotiations in July of 2000. Now, while the Syrian talks foundered, Barak turned to the PA in January of 2000. He offered more withdrawal from land and more prisoner releases, but the debacle was ahead. By April, Arafat was preparing for war as he refused to accept a negotiated state. He made a statement in Israel that he would build a state out of blood and declare that state on September 13th of 2000. Once again, Barak and Clinton were bamboozled. Even as new concessions were offered, Arabs were given control of Abu Dis, right outside Yerushalayim. They even built a parliament in Abu Dis. They'd be able to say that they have a parliament overlooking the Temple Mount. Nonetheless, Arafat unleashes his terror brigades. Bombs at Kever Rachel, bombs throughout Yesha. Arafat essentially was forced to come to Camp David for negotiations in July 2000. Barak was desperate for those negotiations, as his government now controlled only 32 seats in the Knesset. How did they survive in power? It's because the Knesset was in recess and could not vote no confidence. But it was a minority government, but a substantial minority government. He offered, Barak did, far-reaching concessions at Camp David, 95% of the land of Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Yerushalayim is the capital. $30 billion to resettle Arab refugees. Control, Arab control over the Harabayats. All was refused. Not only did Arafat refuse, he refused to make a counteroffer. In one memorable exchange, Arafat said, Israel is offering nothing on the Temple Mount, as there never was a temple in Jerusalem that belonged to the Jews. In July, there was a rally in Tel Aviv against the Camp David negotiations. I happened to be there myself. On July 21st, there was a political sermon at the Al-Aqsa Mosque that came out against any type of agreement, and that Arafat should not sign anything. As to sign anything, he'd be giving away Arab rights. In the colorful words of the Sheikh Ikram Sabri, who was the Mufti of Yerushalayim, appointed by Arafat, he said on July 11th, while the Camp David negotiations were going on, O Allah, destroy America, for she is ruled by Zionist Jews. He assured everyone that, or his listeners, that the Arabs would inherit the Jewish settlements, and he said, I quote, the homes the Jews are building will become Arab property with Allah's help. Allah shall take revenge on behalf of his prophet against the colonialist settlers who are sons of monkeys and pigs. Forgive us, Muhammad, for the acts of these sons of monkeys and pigs who sought to harm your sanctuary. I suppose that Sheikh Sabri does not mind preaching politics from the pulpit. But nonetheless, this was the attitude of the Arab world, that nothing really substantial was happening in Israel, and nothing the substantive was happening. Israel could not be trusted. Arafat insisted on full withdrawal, full return of refugees, or war. Now, even as this was going on, Israel was still playing along as if the Arabs were fighting terror. So in one incident that's recorded by Yosef Bodansky in his book, The High Cost of Peace, Israel provided Jibril Rajoub, the head of the PA Security, Preventive Security Service, with information after a terrorist attack in Taiba about a Hamas safe house in Shechem. When Rajoub's people were unsuccessful, so to speak, in finding the house, Israel said that they would lend them a Hamas prisoner who could point it out. So in fact, they pointed it out. The Hamas leadership in Shechem reached an agreement with the PA on vacating that house without any attribution, and Rajoub refused to return the prisoner to Israel because he could not bring himself to transfer Palestinian to Israeli hands. Jerusalem swallowed the insult and did not disrupt the Washington talks on security cooperation. This was part and parcel of the humiliation which the Oslo process entailed. In September of 2000, while Osama bin Laden and his deputies were meeting in Afghanistan, calling for worldwide jihad against Israel, the United States, and the Christians, Clinton, who was oblivious to that, was still trying to wrest even more concessions from Barack regarding Yerushalayim, assuming that perhaps something would eventually mollify Arafat. Now, Arafat again postponed the declaration of a state in September because he was looking for victory. He even hinted at delaying the inevitable war, earning him the wrath of the Islamists who were ascendant in Gaza, and would in 2001 enter the world scene and American life with a vengeance. Now, these terrorists, these Islamic fundamentalists, resented even hints that would tend to indicate that any Israel of any size could be accepted at any time. So when Arafat instigated his terror war in late September 2000, it was as much to satisfy the Islamist needs as his own bloodlust and Jew hatred. Now, the pretext of the war, which began in September, was the September 28th visit of Ariel Sharon, who had been elected the new leader of Likud, to the Har HaBayit. Now, this is always a hoary tactic of the right wing, to show their bona fides, their credentials, by doing some meaningless symbolic act. Here, Sharon was asserting, ironically, in light of recent events, that Barak was abandoning the Temple Mount. Indeed, Barak supported the visit, as he had accepted the Palestinian offer of PA sovereignty over Har HaBayit, and Barak wanted to dramatize how the PA could be trusted. So in fact, the visit was coordinated with Jibril Rajoub, who was a CIA thug. He was always financed by the CIA until very recently. Rajoub maintains 50 PA police on the Harabayat, but nonetheless, Rajub, always a double dealer, incited the youth to gather stones. Sharon's visit prompted a riot on the Harabayat, which soon spread throughout the land of Israel. The Mitchell Report, George Mitchell, investigating on behalf of the American government, eventually found that there was no link between Sharon's visit and the war itself, but nonetheless, in the popular conception, it was Sharon's visit that sparked it. In reality, the PA minister, Lahoud, said that this war had been planned since Camp David. It was, so to speak, the Great Independence War that would exploit Israel's internal weakness and the IDF's growing contempt for Barak, and the budget cuts that were prompted by the approaching peace that had left the IAF and the IDF, the Air Force and the Army, undertrained and underarmed, and the notion that the Israelis were tired and that they would run from Yesha just like they had from Lebanon. The war began, shootings first began in Gush Etzion, then Gush Katif, and then spread like wildfire across the land. Many attacks were led by the PA police, some in full view of their Israeli counterparts. Kever Yosef in Shechem was attacked, the grave of Yosef, and an IDF Druze soldier was allowed to bleed to death while Barak negotiated for 7 hours his rescue with Rajub. It's hard to believe in retrospect. An IDF soldier was allowed to bleed to death rather than be rescued by other soldiers while Barak negotiated his rescue with the person who had overseen the attack itself, Jibril Rajub. After soldiers were evacuated, Kever Yosef, the grave, was stormed and destroyed. A mosque was built over it. Hillel Lieberman, who spent every day at Kever Yosef, was shot 100 times trying to prevent its desecration. His body was found Motsoi Shabbos Shuva. An IDF statement said, Lieberman, I quote, Lieberman was murdered in cold blood by Palestinian terrorists as he made his way to Nablus. The IDF holds the PA directly responsible and expects the Palestinian Authority to put an immediate end to all the violence. Whether they believed it or not, I don't know. I would hope they did not believe what they were saying, that they expected the PA to end violence, but I'm afraid that they actually did believe it. Arafat ordered an escalation, rebuffing both Clinton and Albright. Arafat, as always, was unafraid of an American response, since he held the key to any signing ceremony. The American government, the Clinton government, would never offend him. Of course, he became Clinton's most frequent foreign visitor. Days later, in October 2000, two Israeli reservists were lynched in Ramallah, which had a galvanizing effect on Israeli society, but being a very volatile society, even that soon faded. But the images of the dead bodies being tossed outside of windows and then pummeled to death and torn apart, that lingered amongst the thinking element in society. Then Iran ordered Hezbollah to attack Hardov, and they captured 3 wounded soldiers. Those soldiers, of course, in the Arab way, were killed in captivity. Their bodies were later traded for live terrorists. Next week, the Iran orchestrated an attack on the USS Cole in Yemen, killing 17 American sailors. Again, there was no response from the Clinton administration. Barak rejected the Shabak assessment that Arafat is the danger to Israeli society, insisting rather that Arafat was the partner for peace. Clinton arranged another October summit at Sharm el-Sheikh, October 2000. The only result, the Mitchell Commission that would formulate what became known as the roadmap. Arafat sought an international force in order to protect the PA enclaves and prevent counterattacks by Israel. As they wrangled over phony ceasefire terms, Arafat authorized the attack on the Kfar Darom school bus. 3 children lost legs, others were murdered. People that I've had the privilege of visiting and seeing their strength. The Americans urged Israel not to respond with what they called excessive use of force. Barak's policy became closing the territories, reopening the territories, closing the territories when there was a terrorist attack, reopening it after it was a few days of quiet. Each opening brought a new wave of terror. This wave of terror was no longer stone-throwing youth, but all-out war, with the Tanzim, a trained paramilitary force, attacking the IDF and civilians at random. And still, Barak refrained from any IDF response, and Israelis would soon try to get accustomed to this new bout of havlaga, of restraint. Meanwhile, President Clinton maintained the symmetry, calling on both sides to refrain from violence, both the aggressor and the victim. CIA leaked the following to protect George Tenet, who was a supporter of Arafat. He said that only Israeli concessions will prevent Arafat's fall and Hamas's rise. Nonetheless, at that point, Israel was incapable of implementing any concessions, even if Barak would agree to more. On December 31st of 2000, Binyamin Kahana and his wife were killed. Hashem Kamdaman, a Tanzim planned mission, hoping that their followers would attack the Arabs, but they did not. And Israel just absorbed death after death, blow after blow. Arafat soon unleashed Islamic Jihad and Hamas, and terror such as Israel had never known began. Barak would meet with Arafat one last time in January 2001 at Taba, in the Egyptian-Israeli border, offering 97% of Yesha, hoping that anything that looks like an agreement would lead to his re-election, but no deal. Barak left office. He was defeated in a landslide, refusing to admit that either Oslo or Camp David or the Lebanon retreat was a failure. That myopia was not limited to him. On February 6, 2001, Ariel Sharon was elected the Prime Minister 62% to 38% in the last direct election for Prime Minister that Israel had, and he formed a new coalition with, of all groups, Labor. 29 ministers in all, almost a third of the Knesset were ministers, a top-heavy government, a recipe for stagnation. Meanwhile, as soon after Sharon took office, in June 2001, Pope John Paul I visited the Middle East and Israel. Assad greeted him, that's Bashar the son, blaming Jews for the troubles of the world, for torturing Jesus and betraying Muhammad. The Pope said nothing. Cardinal Jean-Marie Lustiger, who had accompanied him, of Jewish origin, who died just recently, the Cardinal said that, quote, if this is what Assad thinks about Jews, then to all seeking peace in the Middle East, I say, don't waste your time. Go back to your countries and find something else to do. He spoke the truth in that sense, but very few others did. The Pope's visit was a brief respite. It was tremendous hullabaloo in Israeli society, but he too clung to the moral equivalency, which is the death knell of any sense of justice in the Western world. Meanwhile, the terror continued unabated. In 3 years, from September 2000 until the end of the terror war, almost 900 Israelis were killed in terrorist acts. By proportionate standards, in an American context, that would be the equivalent of 45,000 Americans killed. If you think about September 11th, on which 3,000 Americans were murdered by Arab terrorists, so imagine 15 times that number, 45,000 killed over a three-year period. Suicide bombings in buses, malls, restaurants, discos became features of Israeli life. Bombs with nails to cause more damage in victims. Incessant shootings into Gilo. Shalhevet Pass was shot in the head and murdered by a sniper using a CIA rifle and scope, that in Hebron. Israel knew generally about the Zbaro bombing at the intersection of Rehov Yafo and Rehov HaMelech George, They asked the PA to arrest the soon-to-be perpetrators. The PA refused. Cities were deserted. Tourists stopped coming. The streets were empty. Fear was palpable. Israelis persevered. And yet Sharon did nothing. Even before the election in January of 2001, Arafat's business advisor, Mohammed Rashid, met with Omri Sharon in Vienna to plan their future together, having the business investments in the territories. Sharon's line, restraint is strength. And his tactic was to bomb empty buildings in Gaza every time there was a terrorist act. Why was he so restrained? Well, perhaps it was the legacy of the 1982 Lebanon War, which had damaged his reputation, some thought beyond repair. So Sharon may have wanted a national consensus, certainly the support of the leftists and the media. He wanted international opinion on his side, and of course he wanted the rehabilitation of his reputation. He did not want to be perceived as a warmonger, so instead he would absorb casualties beyond what any nation should have to absorb before they respond. In the end, despite everything that he did, in the eyes of the left, his reputation was rehabilitated. But the Jewish people suffered grievously, an enormous trauma that when it ended left people grasping at even flimsier straws of peace and left them ripe to agree, if not wholeheartedly, at least in large numbers, to the expulsion of Jews from Gush Katif and even more surrender of land. Now, Arafat's terror war followed the advice of Mao Zedong, who had used the same tactic. I quote from Mao, "Enough to demoralize the enemy, but not too much to make them angry." And that essentially worked. Israel became demoralized, but for a long time, almost 7-8 months, not any response that would be able to inhibit or preempt any terrorist attacks. Israel endured 18 months, and as bad as the terror was, the open contempt that the Arabs showed for Israeli and Jewish society was even worse. In June, as Arafat and Tenet negotiated in Ramallah, the PA killed the first person they saw in an Israeli car. Turned out to be a Greek Orthodox monk. The terrorists only saw the license plates. But that was a message to Tenet that nothing that he does will change anything, but of course he should keep trying. Days later, PA double agents meet their Israeli Shin Bet handler outside Beit Lechem, and they shoot him dead. In July, Israeli intelligence intercepts Arafat calling for, quote, one Jew a day to be killed. Still nothing. In August, mortars start falling on Gilo in Yerushalayim. After a brief raid on Beit Lechem, the IDF withdrew and the mortars continued. Even after the Arab terror of September 11th, cheered by the Arab world, including by the Palestinians, they were still restrained. It became near impossible and dangerous to ride the tunnel roads from Yerushalayim to Gush Etzion. Every day, there would be scattered shooting. All the Israeli army did was put up temporary walls to try to deflect the bullets. In a story told to me by a relative of mine, lives in Efrat, he was held up in the tunnel while shooting took place, and then it stopped. He went to proceeded to the checkpoint, at which the IDF soldier said to him, "Drive fast. We don't know when the shooting is going to start again." President Bush, now in power, sent George Tenet, sent Anthony Zinni, and of course Arafat condemned every act of terror, even as he ordered more. In January 2002, it became the turning point for President Bush, the Karine A arms ship was intercepted by Israel en route to Gaza. $15 million worth of weapons, rockets, mortars, anti-tank missiles. It was directly tied to Arafat. Of course, at that point, Bush, who never met Arafat, never had him in the White House, broke off ties with the Palestinian Authority, but for some strange reason, Israel did not. For sure, other weapons were being smuggled. The death toll mounted until Pesach night, March 27th, 2002, at the Park Hotel in Netanya. Suicide bomber enters, blows himself up as the Seder is beginning. 30 Jews were killed, many of them elderly. Hundreds were wounded, and the provocation was sufficient to warrant a forceful offensive response. That began days later with Operation Chomat Magen, Defensive Shield, which was a response of the IDF, which would change the situation on the ground, but would not have a enduring impact on the political dynamic or the security equation in the Middle East. That to be continued on the next CD.